This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I'm Candace Lim, and you're listening to ICYMI. In case you missed it, Slate's podcast about internet culture. And I'm so excited to have Bloomberg Businessweek senior reporter Amanda Moll on the show with me today. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so good. I'm even better because you're here. Look, Amanda, you write the Buying Power column, which follows the intersection between culture and commerce. On top of that, you have had an amazing 5+ year run at The Atlantic, where you have written some of my favorite culture pieces of the last decade. But before we get into that, I have a warm-up question to ask you. Are you ready?
Yes.
It's July. It's hot outside. It's heated online. What is something that has made you happy online recently? It could be a meme. It could be a song. It could be a tweet.
This is not a terribly original answer, I don't think, but I have loved enjoying my brat summer. I have.
Okay, talk about it.
I was not really a Charlie XCX fan before this. Like, I was aware of her. I thought she was cool. She seemed fun. I had heard some of the songs and enjoyed them, but I had not like sought out her albums to listen to. Mm-hmm. Around the time that the album came out, I was getting used to a new commute, and I was looking for, and like a lot of my favorite podcasts were sort of like on summer break or like, you know, sort of like casting around for like random stuff to talk about and like not really understanding what their summer content should be. Yeah. So I was just looking for something to listen to. And I was like, let me try Brat. Let me, you know, and this was when it was like first like popping off. It had just come out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is exactly what I want. This makes me feel like I am doing something other than going to Midtown on the C train. This makes me feel happy. Like, it's just like pure party energy. And like all the Brat memes have been so fun. Like, on my laptop right now where I'm recording, the camera icon is on and it's surrounded in green, and I'm like, that's Brat coded.
Yes.
Like, it's just what my brain does now.
Yes.
So I've been really, really enjoying that. Brat, the album, and then all the memes thereafter have really been good for me lately, I think, in my mental health.
Yeah. You know what my literal favorite Brat meme of the day is? Because it keeps going. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's Bill Hader, Ask Stefan on SNL, set to Guess. And it's perfect. It's perfect. Okay, Amanda, here's my question.
Yes.
You're walking down the street. What's a song you're listening to from Brat?
I really like Von Dutch. Which I think has not gotten like a ton of shine yet. Like, I think it is like probably for most people like a B-tier track on the album, but I really like it. And both 360 and 365, of course, like, you know, it's really hard to start an album like well. I think a lot of my favorite albums, the first track is something that I like only listen to sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But 360 is just like, it's such a good opening track. It is really like, it sucked me into the album immediately. Nothing but respect to Charlie.
Yeah. It's so Julia.
Yes.
Amazing. Okay. That was a very good Amanda answer. For me, I am also in the music discourse lane. Okay. Because I am not going to say what's making me happy is Katy Perry's new song, Woman's World. I'm not going to say that. Okay. I know that the huge conversation has been like, supposed to be feminist anthem. It's unsuccessful satire, coming off very 2016 Hillary's gonna win, not the vibe. Instead, though, I kind of like that this discourse has illuminated two of Katy's previous songs that I love that I really think should have been bigger hits. Those songs are Harley's in Hawaii and Never Really Over. Anyway, I wish we spent this episode talking about Brat, but we're not, because today we are here to get into your internet diaries. So let's take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Amanda about her first internet memory, the first fandom she loved, and the memes she can't get enough of. All that and more after the break. there. If you love our podcast, then maybe you should consider subscribing to Slate Plus. With Slate Plus, there are no ads on any Slate podcasts. And Slate Plus helps keep this podcast going because this show would not be possible without your support. With Slate Plus, you'll get bonus segments and episodes for shows like Hit Parade, Hang Up and Listen, and Slate Money. You'll also never hit a paywall on the Slate website, meaning you get access to every article and every advice column. Just visit slate.com/ICYMI+ to sign up. That's slate.com/ICYMI+. Whether you're listening to ICYMI at double speed or regular speed, you'd probably love to know how you can get double the cash back with your credit card. Either way, we'll slow things down a bit so you don't miss anything. Discover automatically doubles all the cash back you've earned on your credit card at the end of your first year with Cashback Match. Get rewarded no matter who you are or how much you spend with Discover. It pays to discover. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Other realtors have vacant homes. At Pest Properties, ours come occupied and ready to infest. Looking to relocate your larvae? Try the Petri Residence. This rustic home features thousands of crevices to squirm in through, vaulted ceilings for our wall crawlers, and an outdoor bird bath teeming with mosquito eggs. So kick up your six hairy legs and sign today.
Before pests move in, Terminix it. With over 95 years of experience, we'll help keep your home off the pest market. Visit Terminix.com today.
And we're back. I'm here with Amanda Moll, a senior reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, and we are about to dive into her internet diaries. Amanda, are you ready?
Yes.
It is your first time on the show. Therefore, listeners know, I have to ask you the one question we ask all first-time guests. What was your first internet memory?
The first internet memory I have was going over to my friend Erica's house. Mm. Her dad worked in some kind of tech job or had like a small like IT company or something. So in her basement, there was like several desks with computers, and those computers were all hooked up to like their own phone line. We could get online as much as we wanted to, because this was in the era where if I were going to use the internet at my parents' house, it was at the expense of anybody in the house being able to receive a phone call. So like we had it before that. Like I remember having it before that, but like my first memory, like real memory of being able to just like go online and like fish around and like see what was happening and like look at websites sort of like leisurely, like we do now as sort of a matter of course, was going over to Erica's house and like using like the assistant's computer in the basement because they had it set up for internet access that didn't like disrupt the rest of the house. So we sort of like had it to ourselves. Plus, like we were like probably 10 years old, 11 years old. And like she had good parents. Her parents were present. But if we were in the basement, they couldn't like watch us 24/7. So that was that first real memory of like sitting with a friend and like finding stuff that made us laugh online, finding stuff that was weird or that we were unfamiliar with, just like the sort of sense of discovery that the early internet had.
What was like the first website you were kind of obsessed with that you would check like all the time?
There were a bunch of forums online. I am an old school forum girly. Mm-hmm. Like I am a poster going back years. And there was I'm trying to remember the name of it. There's a bunch of like small ones that were like run by other like tween and teenage mm-hmm. girls that like probably only ever had like a couple hundred users at a time. But there was one that was like girl.com, G-U-R-L, I think, .com, something like that, mm-hmm. where it was like a larger like forum that had been set up by like a business and not someone using their parents' credit card and hoping they wouldn't notice it. Mm-hmm. And I remember those forums, and like it was just sort of like a wide ranging set of topics that like you were being prompted to talk about. So there's lots of like pop culture and politics and stuff like that. And the sense of like that there was this like whole world of a lot of people in my sort of like age range, and a lot of people who were probably weirdos pretending to be in my age range out there just like chatting. And if there's one thing I love to do, it is yap.
So, I mean, it's in our DNA.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was just like obsessed with like that forum and like a zillion other tiny ones that probably were like a you know, a blip on the radar. I don't remember how I found any of these places because, like, Google search was not a significant force on the internet yet. Alta Vista, Ask Jeeves, things of that nature probably were what led me to, like, the first couple. But yeah, I was obsessed with internet forums, and they were, like, foundational to my understanding of the internet.
Yeah. And the forums found you. And I love that we're talking about this because it makes me want to ask, what was the first fandom you joined, and, like, where did you find them?
I was in middle school when Titanic came out, and I got in so deep with the Titanic girls online. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of a, you know, I don't want to say it's the internet's, like, first, like, teen girl fandom, because it probably wasn't. There's probably other things happening that I wasn't aware of. But it was, like, a confluence of, like, the early internet and, like, something that was, like, for 13-year-old girls. And it was a huge cultural phenomenon that, like, took everybody's attention to it for a while. And that was enough time for, like, fan sites to pop up, for forums themselves to pop up, for this entire sort of, like, ecosystem of fandom around Titanic, comprised almost entirely of the people that we, like, most closely associate with fandom now, mm-hmm. who were sort of, like, figuring out how to do this online, how to coordinate and find, like, like-minded people. And, like, you know, there weren't really, like, videos or anything. Like, right. The internet was not fast enough for that. Like, YouTube didn't exist. But you would get GIFs. You would get people reposting stills from movies that you would have to, like, sit there and wait for one to download so you could look at it. I remember printing out a bunch of stuff. My mom was not pleased with that because it took a lot of ink. Ink was not cheap. Ink still isn't cheap. I had, like, a binder full of, like, stuff that I had printed off the internet, and people with, like, slightly faster internet connections out there were doing God's work in sort of, like, building these very early places to sort of, like, gather and, like, comment about it. I remember there was a lot of MIDI files, a lot of, like, My Heart Will Go On in MIDI form. Yes, I was extremely into Titanic fandom, and I'm not, like, a fandom person. I have not, like, gotten into many fandoms afterward, but for some reason I was, like, the exact right age and right persuasion to really go headfirst into Titanic online.
I love that. Now, fast forwarding to you now, I feel like a lot of fandoms now kind of congregate at Reddit. Are you a Reddit person right now?
I am. I do not really post on Reddit, but I have an extensive curated list of Reddits that I read.
Who are you checking? Where are you looking?
Well, I sort of look all over the place. Like, Reddit, I think, is a really useful reporting tool. It is full of retail employees or people who work for different brands, different types of services, who congregate to, like, talk about their jobs publicly. It's really hard to find any sort of, like, public discussion of what it's like to work for, like, a big retailer or for a big brand, except on Reddit. There's just, like, not a lot of other places or other fora that allow that. Like, like, the USPS has its own separate, like, offsite for Target employees have, like, a separate one, but, like, it's really accessible if you want to just have, like, a sort of passive feed of, like, information popping up, or, like, just check the temperature on, like, how employees of Target or Walgreens or whatever are feeling, or what they're seeing in their stores. It is a really, really fascinating look into that. So it's, like, really useful on a professional level for me, like, just to see what is happening in stores in a way that, like, would be difficult for me to see otherwise. But also, like, I love r/frogs. It's just one of those random things that got pushed into my feed at some point. The secret sauce on Reddit, I truly don't understand sometimes how certain things end up on my, like, homepage. You know, it's less obtrusive than, like, the FYP or something like that. It's not, like, as algorithmically driven, but, like, occasionally there's just something random inserted in there, and it's like, huh. But I ended up joining the frog subreddit and just, like, looking at these cool frogs. Like, I have never been a frog fan, but, like, the pictures of frogs were cool enough, and, like, the discussion of frogs was, like, sort of endearing. And I was like, this is, like, the type of thing that that the internet is, like, really good for, but that gets crowded out to the margins, I think. So I love r/frogs. I love Reddit. Like, I think it's a really underutilized, and it's, like, the only thing that I don't feel compelled to post on personally, which is a big relief when, like, your job and your thoughts are so public facing, to have, like, a spot where it's like, oh, I don't feel like I have to talk about myself or things I know about here at all. I can just, like, browse around and see what people are doing.
Yeah. I like what you're saying about the place that retail subreddits have in that forum, because you get both sides. You really get a transparency that you think the clear window shows you, but it's like, no. Those people are like employees, and now they're humans, and they're talking about that experience. And I really like that. I want to ask you about that very thin divide between consumer reporter, because I think something that maybe you and I have in common is the fact that, look, we cover the internet, we talk about culture, but sometimes you go on the internet, you see something, and a part of you is like, that could be a story, even though it's a weekend and you're like kind of off, but you're never really off. My question for you is like, how do you separate your consumer self versus your reporter self? And like, how do you have fun on the internet when it's kind of your job?
That's a great question, because like, I think that like over time I have come to have like less and less fun on the internet. And I think that that's not necessarily like a unique thing about me or about people who work in these kinds of jobs. I think the internet has just in some ways gotten less fun, or the things that like I look to for fun have like changed, and I haven't fully readjusted to like what the other places to look for fun are. But you're right that like my sort of story brain is always going. I interact with the internet as a consumer, as someone who orders stuff online, who, you know, contracts for services online, who uses delivery apps and Amazon and whatever else. And I think that I've been at this long enough to where like a bunch of the stuff that I would just encounter every day is already stuff that I have written about. So I can sort of like put that aside and not be as actively processing it as like a fodder for a story. But then when things jump out, like that is usually meaningful, when like when I stop and go, this is weird. Like, why is this happening? Why am I encountering this? Why has this changed? That is usually like a good instinct to trust for me, but it never really gets shut off. Like, I end up, you know, making a lot of notes about like, oh, talk to my editor about this on Monday or in the morning or whatever. Because a lot of those interactions and a lot of that like spark of inspiration does come in sort of like weird spots. So I haven't ever really found like an effective way to separate out my own existence on the internet from my existence on the internet as a writer and as a reporter. And I don't necessarily think that that is like possible for me. Although like on Reddit and on TikTok, where like I do not actively participate, I think that those are sort of the places that I go to sort of like turn my brain off in the way that a lot of people use like other parts of the internet. TikTok is great for reporting reasons for me too, because like it's such a shopping focused app. People use that app like they are involved in the consumer economy in a way that I don't think they would have considered themselves to be involved in the consumer economy like 10 years ago. There's a lot of like sort of active participation in like encouraging other people to shop, or like being curatorial, or sort of thinking about things like a marketer or like a branding person instead of like just a person who is the sort of recipient of all of these efforts. And that is sort of fascinating in a like story generation way. Like, it is interesting to me to see people acting like that, because it is like a new way that people are participating in consumer culture. But like, I don't think it would be productive for me to post on TikTok.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. Well, Amanda, this is the beginning of your internet diary. We have a lot more to get to. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to do some rapid fire questions and ask you questions like, what's your golden rule for engaging with people online?
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds Gummy Clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're gonna love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Tired of listening to the same old playlists or podcasts over and over? Maybe it's time to mix things up. Try something new. Hit explore. before you've even put your buds in, grab a bowl of Pebbles cereal and put some fun in the mix. You'll be listening to the good stuff soon enough. Fruity and Cocoa Pebbles cereal. Less blah, more yabba dabba doo. Head to your nearest grocery store to buy Pebbles cereal now. Yabba dabba doo and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements. Copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
And we're back. So, Amanda, I actually want to do a quick pivot and talk about your writing a little bit because, you know, we've cited your work on the show before, especially when you were over at The Atlantic, where you wrote some really great pieces about, like, the HGTVification of America, Peloton, girl bosses. But what I actually want to ask you about are the pieces you wrote during the pandemic, because starting in 2020, you know, you were reporting on things like how to get food during the pandemic, panic moving, how the pandemic changed friendships. And looking back, what was it like to write those pieces at a time when the only culture during the pandemic was the pandemic?
That was a really difficult period. Like it was, I think it was a difficult period for everybody. It was a difficult period to figure out like how I should be marshaling my skills such as they are in order to give attention to the right things, to illuminate things that people are curious about. It was just a really difficult period to figure out how to like reorient myself around what I'm supposed to be doing and like what is actually useful to be doing. But ultimately, like the pandemic was, in the context of a lot of the things that I write about, the pandemic wasn't something that changed everything, but it was something that accelerated a lot of things. As far as like the actual product of my work goes, it was in hindsight like a very interesting period to see what the forces are that sort of push particular trends forward. And when I say trends in that context, I don't mean like TikTok trends. I mean like large scale differences in people's behavior or thinking or purchasing or whatever, just sort of like trends in the most like value neutral way of considering that word. If you were paying close attention, you got a lot of insight, I think, into how people change their behavior and how they don't, and like why they change their behavior and why they don't. And fundamentally, consumerism is a behavioral phenomenon. It is a lot of people who are being pushed on and pulled on by forces beyond their control and sometimes beyond their perception to perform certain tasks, to do certain things, to think certain ways, to believe in certain things, and to spend money as a result. And the pandemic was a window into how those forces work on a, like a really grand scale, because the pandemic sort of forced people to reshuffle a lot of their beliefs, a lot of their behaviors, a lot of the ways that they sort of think about everyday life on a really fundamental level. And a lot of those behaviors have gone back to like what they were prior to the pandemic. For some people, they have not, for health reasons or for cautious reasons, but you get sort of an opportunity to see what the pressures and what the changes are and then how people react to them. And I think that that is really instructive. If you're looking for stories, if you're looking to understand why people do what they do, why people believe what they believe, why people spend money on the things that they spend money on, like what their values are, because ultimately, like that is what consumer behavior is people figuring out how to allocate the resources they have to the things that they enjoy or are scared of or are interested in. And the pandemic was like a really grand lesson in how that works.
Yeah. And I think that at that time, a lot of reporting felt so building the runway as the plane's taking off.
Yes.
This vibe of like, I think I know, but I also don't know, but also like I'm also going through stuff. And so I wanted to ask, is there anything that you've written about or a take you had at the time that you've kind of changed your mind on or even like flipped a little bit?
There are like lots of little calls that you make sort of day to day in like the production of like a piece of writing or a piece of reporting that like end up being wrong.
Yeah.
I had an incorrect Peloton take during that time. And my former coworker, Derek Thompson, has a podcast. And I said it on his podcast because Peloton is one of his pet interests as well. When Peloton was on the downswing and they were trying to figure out what to do to sort of like stanch the bleeding and get the business back to growth and get it back to customer retention. I said on Derek's podcast that like I figured Peloton would figure it out because ultimately I assumed that they had to know that what they were operating was like a subscription and software business and not a hardware business. Because I thought like the entire time that I've been covering Peloton, which goes back to like 2018, 2019, it's been clear to me that that is the business, not the hardware. Like the bikes and the treadmills and stuff are great. Like they're nice pieces of equipment, but like that's really hard to scale. They're very expensive. And I figured as things wore on, like after the end of the most acute phase of the pandemic, when they were having problems with sales of that hardware, that like, of course they knew that like that was not the future of the business. So I figured they would be fine. A couple years later, it has become very clear that they did not see that at the time the way that I did at all, that they believed they were running a hardware business and not one that needed to continue to grow on like subscription revenue and their use of their content library and their software. And I think they were wrong about that. I think that other people who watch the company would agree that they were wrong about that. And it just at the time, I did not believe that they could be that wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you were wrong at the time, because when you see like successful businesses and like dig into the DNA, a lot of them will say that our success is due to our ability to pivot. And so I think for a lot of people, they were like, they'll pivot. It's fine. It's fine. The issue now is that Pelotons are the new Bird scooters. They're all over the road. They're just on the side, anchors away, and no one wants them anymore. And so that's kind of where they're at now. Although, you know what? A great replacement for a Peloton, guys? A bike. Regular, non-electronic, just bike. Two wheels. Two wheels. Now, Amanda, I think it's time to do a little bit of a rapid fire questionnaire. I'm going to hit you with some questions. Just say the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
Okay.
Here we go. What meme do you reference the most?
It's a selection of Drill tweets, really.
Ooh, okay.
Drill has like rewritten certain things that happen inside of my brain. But like the candles tweet about like, you know, can somebody help me budget this? My family is dying. I say like, please, my family is dying. A lot.
Yeah.
The celebs are at it again. Mm-hmm, I regret to report the celebs are at it again. That one in various forms I say constantly.
Yeah.
You know, the brands are at it again. The brands are always at it. Totally. So I paraphrase it as that a lot. Like those are probably the two biggest ones. Like you don't got to hand it to them. So many of the classic Drill tweets have just like slightly rewritten how my brain works and how I relate to language.
Yeah.
They're so useful without a doubt. Like some of those tweets are probably like 7-8 years old.
Sure.
And still.
Yeah. I love that. Okay. What is your most deeply held but least provable internet conspiracy theory?
I believe that, like, you know, on some level, I believe that there are, like, a lot of, not necessarily lefty, but, like, lefty and progressive posters on Twitter. Like, not all of them. Some of them are just authentically annoying people, but, like, some of them, I think, probably are ops of some sort. Like, the FBI or the NSA or something is running an operation to make leftists seem more annoying than they are, or to collect like identities of progressives or activists or whatever. And like some of that, like, I don't know about online, but like historically, like those are methods that federal law enforcement does use to collect the names of activists and things like that, and to disrupt movements. And I think that it probably happens online a little bit more than we are strictly aware of at this point.
Yeah. In that vein, I guess mine actually is that I think the government has recruited people to be K-pop stans, and they are just trying to figure out who are the most easily succumbable to union efforts. Just anyway.
Yeah. Sort of in that vein. I think that probably various law enforcement sources are probably among us online.
Literally. Okay. What are your personal rules for engaging online? Like, how often do you post? Who do you pick? Like who you're going to fight and who you're going to ignore.
I try not to fight on the internet as much as I used to. Like, and I have never been one to shy away from like confrontation or from conflict in that way. I try not to do it so much anymore because I don't think it is healthy.
Yeah.
I try not to get sucked in because like, I think after a while on the internet, and especially if when once you become like visible on the internet to like more people than you can reasonably keep track of, your audience online becomes like asymmetrical mm-hmm. in like a real way, which for me was like around the 10,000 Twitter followers mark. So it's been that way for a long time. I post a lot less than I used to before I started working at my last job at The Atlantic. The only thing that I could do was post, really. Like, I didn't have like a fancy media job. I, you know, had done some freelancing, but like the only way to like continue to work in media and to find work was to just like be out there with my ideas and my personality, sort of like panning around for opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I posted a lot then. And then also like my employer at the time, like as long as I didn't get like insane, they didn't care what I posted. But then like I started working at The Atlantic, and The Atlantic, like many mainstream media outlets, has tighter strictures on like how you as an employee and as a journalist are allowed to present yourself online. So I post a lot less than I used to because it is often not worth running afoul of those issues, I would say. And, you know, Bloomberg is not different. They have, you know, standards that we're all held to as employees and as journalists. So I try to not get in trouble in those ways. I feel like it is still pretty clear from my posts who I am. I post a little bit on Blue Sky now. I still post on Twitter. I still post my work on Twitter primarily. I post most freely about sports, I think. Okay. Like, I am a big sports fan.
One last question. If you were to institute one rule that everyone on the internet had to follow, what would it be?
If you're going to have a public conversation on Twitter or any similar social network, you can go back and forth 3 times before both parties Ooh. Have to shut up.
Ooh, I like
take it,
that.
Take it to the DMs if you want to go further than that. We don't need to see, like, I like that. You know. And if you don't want to take it to the DMs, that means you should both go your separate ways and find something else to do with your time.
Okay, that's the show. Thanks to Amanda Mull for joining me on today's episode. You can find her at Amanda Mull on Twitter. We'll be back in your feed on Saturday, so definitely subscribe. That way, you never miss an episode. Leave us a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify, and tell your friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod, and you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com. ICYMI is produced by Sierra Spragley-Ricks and me, Candace Lim. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's vice president of audio. See you online or on the Frog subreddit.